Our first speaker today is Professor David Schoenbrod. He has taught environmental law, legal institution and administrative law, and energy and natural resources regulation at New York Law School since 1984. He has, previous to that, been an attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council and clerk for Spotswood Robinson on the DC Circuit. Currently, he's working on a book on the delegation doctrine that will be published by the Yale University Press. Professor Schoenbrod.
I'm going to be talking about the last part of the topic of this panel, which is the delegation of legislative power. That, of course, is what happens where a statute authorizes the executive to make rules of conduct. In other words, where you have the lawmakers in Congress giving an agency the power to make law. Now, this is accepted as a very important part of our government today, and my purpose is to urge you to begin to rethink whether this is a wise and good thing. Now, I want to contrast the situation that we've been talking about so far today, which is where the Congress tries to take away some of the president's power from a situation where Congress gives the president some of Congress's own power. There's quite a contrast as to how presidents from Franklin Roosevelt to Ronald Reagan and beyond have treated these two situations. Presidents have been very happy to take power from Congress. They haven't been so happy to have Congress tread on their own turf. And that seems understandable. However, when presidents have objected to Congress treading on their turf, they claim principle. They claim the principle of separation of powers, and they say that this is the kind of thing that the framers of the Constitution will lead to tyranny. But as Judge Silberman pointed out just recently in today's earlier panel, the real purpose that we want to protect the president under separation of powers is in order to protect the people. And it seems to me the same concern ought to apply full well to where Congress gives its power to the president. Because in terms of the framers' thinking, both type of situations present the same evil. Too much power in too few hands. And what's going on, obviously, with delegation is that type of concentration of power has gone on in a massive scale. One only has to drive around town and see those big office buildings full of agencies to know that that's the case. Why is it that I believe that the delegation of legislative powers should be taken seriously? I invite you to think about the analogy between budget deficits and the delegation of legislative power. Where you have a budget deficit, Congress gets to take claim the credit for the spending, but the cost, the blame for the cost of the spending don't fall on Congress. They accrue via inflation, future interest on the national debt, and future taxes. So that skewed up exposure of Congress to the benefits and the costs of spending lead to a bias in favor of excessive spending. Exactly the same problem inheres in the delegation of legislative power. I mean, think of the normal scenario. Congress identifies problem. Congress tells the executive to do something about it. Of course, the executive is the one that has to issue the rules to do something about it. They take the blame, the executive takes the blame for the costs of fixing the problem. And so you see what's going on here. Congress gets the claim to claim most of the credit for solving the problem. The blame for the costs falls on the executive. And so you have a bias in terms of overregulation. In other words, it's quite possible for things that a majority might not approve to get passed and made into law via this mechanism. Now, contrast this to the type of rulemaking process that our framers had in mind, which is, of course, Article I. They were concerned about government being able to make rules so freely, and so they said before you could have a rule, you have to have the House Act, the Senate Act, and the President sign. And of course, if the President vetoes, then you need a supermajority. But basically, it all boils down to a supermajority requirement before you can make rules. Now, that's quite a difference. And that difference is well illustrated by what went on with the 50% congressional pay increase. Congress delegates to a commission the authority to give it more pay. They say 50% pay increase for Congress. And Congress is about to let it go through, even though a supermajority of the public, about like 80%, was against it. Now, that didn't quite work, but it almost worked. But there are zillions of other regulations where I think things that a majority would be against go through because of the political flim-flam that's involved in the delegation of legislative power. So why is it that presidents from Reagan back to Roosevelt spend so much more time thinking about encroachments on executive power than on the other way around? Why is it that in the agenda of our conference this weekend, so much less focus is on delegation of legislative power than on other aspects of separation of power? I have a number of reasons, four reasons. One, Congress is acting with the pretense that it's acting in the public interest. We're giving away our power for the public good. But of course, they're not giving away their power because they have plenty of control over what the agencies do. What they're giving away is accountability for their power. Second, the executive. The executive gets a trade-off when there's a delegation of legislative power. The executive gets the power to make the rules, but of course takes the blame for whatever is wrong with the rules, or if the president doesn't act as quickly as Congress wants the president to, or acts too vigorously, whatever, the president gets scolded by Congress. But very often that blame is felt by the next president. So it's a happy enough situation. The president signs the bill unless the next president gets scolded. The third factor I want to point to is the judiciary's interest. Now, as you all remember or know about, back during the New Deal, the Supreme Court did take the delegation doctrine seriously, and President Roosevelt threatened to pack the court, chop the court's head off, in essence. So I think judicial fear is a reason why the doctrine doesn't get taken seriously. The fourth reason I think it doesn't get taken seriously is that there are some very serious questions about that go to whether or not the delegation doctrine can work. One question is, do we have a judicially manageable test of delegation? Another question is, could our government really function without delegation? Another question is, will we get rules that are more or less in the public interest if we did without delegation? Now, all of these questions seem to get answered against the delegation doctrine during the New Deal. However, that was a time when we were traumatized by the Depression. That wasn't a time when we were thinking about how the world would be if we had wholesale delegation. Well, now we've had it. And we've seen that a lot of the intellectual foundation that underlay the New Deal's approach is just plain wrong. It rested upon theories about how the world would work, which just have not panned out. So I think it's time for all of us to begin to take the delegation of legislative powers very seriously, and surely not to urge the emerging, hopefully, democracies in Eastern Europe to copy us in this regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. Our second speaker on the panel is someone who's familiar to everyone in the Federalist Society, Judge Frank Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit. He's also a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago Law School, where he was formerly a full-time faculty member, teaching courses in constitutional law, the Supreme Court, antitrust, and securities regulations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I've been told that we have 10 minutes for these talks. Now, in the Seventh Circuit, 10 minutes is the amount of time we give appellants with hopeless cases for oral argument. And I was hoping that this was not a reflection on what I was about to say. I shall try to persuade you that the allocation of time should have been greater. This is a panel about presidential lawmaking authority. I'd like to treat that broadly to include the sources and scope of presidential power in general, because I want to discuss a question that was opened from the floor during the first panel. That is, the extent to which the president may act on the basis of constitutional views at variance with the law Congress has enacted. An example, President Reagan refused to implement part of the Competition in Contracting Act of 1984, which required protests over contract awards to be referred to the Comptroller General. The Comptroller General isn't an executive official, and President Reagan thought that the reference would be a violation of the separation of powers. Now, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit thought this presumptuous, indeed, thought it unconstitutional for the president to take the Constitution into account in making an enforcement decision, largely on the ground that it invaded the province of the courts and was inconsistent with the clause requiring the president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. What could be less faithful, the court asked, than refusing to enforce the law? There turns out to be a very long history of presidents acting on the basis of their constitutional views at variance with the law. Let me give you two unproblematic examples. Congress passes the Alien and Sedition Acts, essentially making seditious libel a crime. People who are prosecuted under these laws raise the defense that it is unconstitutional. The defense is uniformly rejected. President Jefferson, when he comes to office, pardons these people on the stated ground that the Alien and Sedition Acts are unconstitutional. Second case, the Supreme Court holds that Congress has the power to establish the Bank of the United States, but the legislation authorizing it has expired. Congress promptly passes a new authorization for the Bank of the United States, which President Andrew Jackson promptly vetoes on the ground that the legislation is unconstitutional because the Supreme Court is wrong. Now, I think these cases are generally deemed unproblematic. In both cases, there is no take care problem. Pardon power is explicitly a power to do otherwise than the way the law requires, and there is no problem in vetoing a law before it comes into force. Those are express powers, and one must think that if the president has any power to consider prudence, he can also consider the constitutional role. The very first veto that was cast by any president was cast by President Washington exclusively on constitutional grounds. It was the bill providing the initial apportionment for members of the House of Representatives among states. President Washington thought it was unconstitutional, and he sent up a veto message limited to that ground, written by a fellow by the name of Jefferson. Now, there are some other non-problematic, or at least non-controversial cases. For example, the Supreme Court in the 1970s held unconstitutional quite a number of provisions of the Social Security Act on the ground that they discriminated on account of sex. The Social Security Act was just riddled with sex-based provisions. And the executive branch, after each of these decisions, would go through the statute finding other provisions that were sufficiently like the ones the Supreme Court had held unconstitutional, and would then refuse to enforce them on constitutional grounds. In fact, the administrations of Ford and Carter did this so frequently that Congress started enacting appropriations riders requiring the Department of Justice to notify Congress every time it refused on constitutional grounds to enforce an enacted statute. But the power to do that is, I think, generally taken as uncontroversial. Let me give you some ones that are controversial. In the Ford administration, Congress enacts the Advisory Committee Act, requiring open meetings of advisory committees. The question arises, is the ABA's Standing Committee on the Federal Judiciary an advisory committee? President Ford concludes that it is, and nonetheless refuses to enforce it on constitutional grounds, on the ground that it interferes with his constitutionally given powers. He did this on the advice of Attorney General Levy, who did it in part on the advice of the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel, one Antonin Scalia. Second, President Wilson fires a postmaster who under the law had statutory tenure, despite believing that he has the power to dispose of these officials, as President Eisenhower later did a member of the War Claims Commission. What President Wilson did was upheld ultimately by President Taft, who had then been transmuted into Chief Justice of the United States in a case called Myers against the United States. What President Eisenhower did was not upheld. Then there is the granddaddy of this line, Andrew Johnson, Sachs Secretary of War Stanton, a viper in a beleaguered camp, despite the Tenure of Office Act, which forbade him from replacing one cabinet member until another had already been confirmed. Stanton refused to leave office. Johnson was impeached, and only his acquittal by a very close vote in the Senate persuaded Stanton to vamoose from the Department of War. And there are, as we know, ongoing disputes about intelligent activities and the War Powers Act, as Secretary Cheney reminded us. Now, was President Johnson trapped by the Tenure of Office Act to not be able to get rid of Secretary Stanton? Was Ford trapped by the Advisory Committee Act? Or President Reagan by the Competition in Contracting Act? The argument that they are takes one of three lines. One is that the Take Care Clause of the Constitution requires the president to implement the law, constitutional or not. Second argument is that although judges have the necessary expertise to make constitutional decisions, executive branch officials do not. The third argument is the argument from chaos that if the executive branch could refuse to enforce statutes on constitutional grounds, we would have chaos that is avoided by leaving these tasks to the judiciary. I view the latter two of these three as makeweights. Take the expertise argument. The president acts on the advice of the attorney general, who acts on the advice of the solicitor general and the assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel. The men who hold that office do not sound to me like amateurs. Let me give you some recent names. Rehnquist, Scalia, Bork, McCree, Olson, Starr, and earlier, Jackson, Taft, Hughes, Cox, Griswold, and the man who wrote the veto message for President Jackson in the Bank of the United States case, a fellow by the name of Roger Taney, who was, as many of you know, promoted for good service in the cause. As for chaos, there is only one president. I mean, someone desiring chaos could do no better than to delegate constitutional questions to 600 district judges, reviewed by 168 circuit judges sitting in panels of three. If you wished to find a method to generate babble, you would pick that one. It is, by the way, a task in which we have acquitted ourselves well. A unitary executive always does better than a hydra-headed, uncoordinated judiciary in this respect. And indeed, it was one of the principal arguments for a unitary executive in 1787. This leaves the Take Care Clause. There is a duty to enforce, not a duty to negate. But it is, I think, a very misleading argument. For the president must take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Is the Constitution a law? If it is, then the president must execute it too. In any contest between the Constitution and a statute, the Constitution wins. So I invite you to step back and ask, why is it that there is any form of constitutional review? Why is there judicial review? The argument given by Chief Justice Marshall in Marbury against Madison was quite simple. It is, the Constitution is law. We departed from the United Kingdom by having a written and therefore an enforceable constitution. It has a structure, it has limitations on powers, and it has a supremacy clause that creates a hierarchy with the Constitution on top. It requires all officers to take an oath to the Constitution, to that hierarchy, in other words. So in the event of conflict, the Constitution wins. Now that turns out to be an insufficient argument on behalf of Marbury, because the tough question is not whether the Constitution is superior to a law, but who shall decide the ranking? One could say that Congress, by enacting the statute, has decided that it satisfies all constitutional obligations. If the Congress approve, who are the judges to doubt it? Chief Justice Marshall's answer was essentially, in this governmental structure, every man for himself. Every official owes a duty to the hierarchy and must make his judgment and cannot knuckle under to the views of others. And that is an especially strong argument when the power claimed is one of self-abnegation. Marbury was not a claim by the Supreme Court to compel other branches to dance to the court's view of the Constitution's meaning. It was a claim by the Supreme Court that Congress could not enforce, could not compel it to take original jurisdiction in a case, that is to decide a case, that the Constitution did not allow it to decide. Now translate this form of reasoning to the executive branch. The hierarchy is the same. The duty to the Constitution is the same. The role of each constitutional official to make his own decision is the same. And when the president refuses to enforce a law, it is at the core of that power. That is, it is a self-denying power. Now, if you view this as an argument that is too arid to be persuasive, how about an example? Congress is inflamed by the failure of the drug war, and it passes this law in two sections. One, the president shall summarily execute Czar Bennett and his claque, and the president shall confiscate their property, and none of their lineal descendants shall be eligible for any public office. Two, no court shall have jurisdiction to stay any enforcement of Section 1. Now, I take it that this is a bill of attainder, with the corruption of blood feature that the framers found particularly repugnant. Whether or not we would think Section 2, the jurisdictional clause, effective, the president has a problem. Does he send the firing squad now? Right? I think it quite obvious that the president must not send the firing squad, that he must refuse to execute that law without waiting for a district judge in Washington, D.C. to tell him that that is a bill of attainder. Now, if that's so, we are all done. We have established that the president must decide these questions for himself. And let us suppose you don't accept that. Let us suppose you think it matters whether somebody gets judicial review. And let us suppose that Czar Bennett gets judicial review, but a henchman, call him Barry, does not. Must the president execute Barry? Well, if the president can't set the Constitution over law, why could he spare Barry, even on the basis of a decision favoring Bennett? Why, indeed, if he can't set the Constitution over law, could he spare Bennett? The court interprets the Constitution. If the law trumps the Constitution under the Take Care Clause, then presumably it must trump the judicial decree as well. Yet that's absurd, because it implies that there is no legitimate judicial role at all. And if we grant to judicial opinions any general force beyond the parties to the litigation, that must be because the Constitution of its own force prevails over the law. And the decision by the judges shows what the meaning of that Constitution is, but it is the Constitution that then prevails. Then the president can act on the basis of the decision, on the basis of the Constitution, and not merely implement judicial decrees. And we are all temporary office holders, and the particular group of office holders at First Street that interprets the Constitution is not fundamentally different in that respect from the group on Pennsylvania Avenue and the group at 9th Street and Constitution. The Department of Justice no less abuts Constitution Avenue than the building of the Supreme Court. The source of authority is our founding document, and all contemporary office holders are but squatters in that mansion. All owe their duties to the real owners. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. As to the time, I'll accord you the same courtesy I'm sure you provide the litigants in your court. The next speaker is a representative of the second or first branch of government, the United States Congress, chief counsel in litigation to the U.S. House of Representatives for the last 12 years. In that capacity, Stephen Ross assists the leadership and the committees of the House on matters relating to conduct of congressional investigations. Steve Ross.
Good afternoon. I was asked to come before what I was assured would be a very receptive audience to hear the views of one who has spent his time representing the position of the House of Representatives in litigation fairly often against the executive branch on questions of separation of powers. The topic was described to be that of presidential lawmaking, although to hear it described and enunciated by those on the panel, it could easily, just as easily, be described as presidential law breaking. And I say that because the notion that the president can simply decide to suspend a law because in his view it does not comport with his reading of the Constitution is one that goes to the very essence of our system of government and the rule of law in this nation. It is one that was a considerable dispute and issue in the history of England that led to the development of the English Bill of Rights, which served as a predecessor for the Take Care Clause, and in fact was one of the specific things won in the Glorious Revolution and agreed to by King James. Now, that is not to say that the president does not have a very specific obligation and duty to interpret the Constitution and to apply his reading of the Constitution to the laws of the United States. There are a number of manners in which that is done, and Judge Easterbrook, in describing what he considered to be the two non-controversial or non-problematic questions of presidential constitutional interpretation, gave perfect examples of those. The one that I would focus on is on the veto, because that is one of the specific topics for this panel. Clearly, a president has it within his power, and it could be argued within his obligation, to veto a bill that he believes to be unconstitutional. The Constitution gives him that power as the main mechanism of protecting not only the prerogatives of the presidency, but also the American people from potential encroachment of unconstitutional or unwise congressional enactments. And presidents have been diligent and I think can be trusted to continue to be diligent to preserve that power through a vigorous use of their veto pen and should be encouraged to do so. That is not to say that a president can, with the same sense of constitutional authority, simply allow a statute to become law, perhaps even sign it into law, and then simply say that we are going to ignore and make believe this law was never enacted. There is a presumption of validity to duly enacted statutes which should apply, and that presumption should continue until such time as a court of competent jurisdiction has deemed the statute to be unconstitutional and therefore null and void. It is not a question of the judges having a monopoly on wisdom with regard to the Constitution. I would like to think that those who populate the halls of Congress, as well as those in the executive branch, are able to read the Constitution. But clearly, no branch is going to be 100% correct. If there was complete and ultimate wisdom on the Constitution, then we would never have to fear from an unconstitutional act. It would never get past the halls of Congress and would never be signed into law. But there must be some system of government that prevails in how questions of constitutionality are going to be addressed. And in this government, that system is that a law is brought before a court, and the court, in the performance of its functions, deems it to be either constitutional and therefore to be followed, or unconstitutional and therefore null and void. It seems to me that the alternatives are of significant risk to the very structure of our government. Judge Easterbrook pointed out the decision by President Johnson to ignore a congressional statute and to go ahead and fire Secretary Stanton, a decision that led to a constitutional confrontation and the impeachment and trial of a president. Clearly, that should not be the model of appropriate behavior within the government. I think that the determination with regard to the Competition and Contracting Act is an excellent illustration of both the pitfalls of a presidential suspension of a statute and the practical benefits of judicial resolution, which is the preferred alternative. When the Department of Justice advised the director of OMB to instruct officers of the government to ignore the provisions of the Competition and Contracting Act, it created considerable concern in the Congress. And as the case was proceeding in before the judiciary in both the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit, the President's men were called before the appropriate committees of the Congress to explain their position. It is interesting to note that in explaining their position, both as to the question of the constitutionality of the statute and as to the appropriateness of the executive branch's behavior in ignoring and suspending that statute, the following things were said. The Attorney General said that it was within the executive branch's purview not only to ignore the statute before any judicial resolution, but that clearly the executive branch could continue to ignore the statute upon a resolution by the district court. And here I quote the Attorney General, who said that there was question as to the district court's competence to decide a question of constitutionality. When he was asked, well, what about a court of appeals ruling, he said, well, that would certainly be a matter that the executive branch would take under advisement, but would not consent to the notion that at that point the executive branch would be compelled to follow the law. Now, it's interesting that on the underlying question of the constitutionality that the president's lawyers were so sure of, that they were willing to instruct all officers of the government to ignore a duly enacted and signed into statute provision, that the ultimate resolution of the question of the constitutionality was decided against the executive's position, and that the constitutionality of the Competition and Contracting Act was upheld in both circuits in which it had been tested. And so I think that recent history, as well as the history of both England and the history at the time of the framing of the Constitution, should give considerable pause to those who would argue that the president's proper role in interpreting the Constitution extends to an instruction that a statute should be ignored. And I think that the Commonwealth is better served by the notion that the president has ample opportunity to impress upon the Congress his position and his view of the Constitution with regard to a statute during the legislative process, in which the president plays a extensive role, and particularly through the methodology of the veto, which presidents have used time and again to support their view of the Constitution, and should not extend to the presumptive power of being able to suspend a duly enacted statute. It's interesting to note that while Judge Easterbrook was willing to advocate that position from this podium, that in fact no judge of the United States sitting in his official capacity and speaking as a court has endorsed the view espoused on behalf of the president. That when the Department of Justice was arguing in favor of the of their position in the Competition and Contracting Act cases, that they were unable to cite on their side any decision or any language supporting them issued as an official ruling of a United States court. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. Our final speaker in today's panel is Mr. Theodore Olson. He is a partner in the law firm of Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher here in Washington, and the partner in charge in the Washington office, in fact. Previous to serving in that firm, he was the Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legal Counsel in the Reagan administration from the years of 1981 to 1984. Let's welcome Ted Olson.
First of all, as to the time limitations, it reminded me of the story I read in Esquire. They had 47 jokes for Christmas, and one of them was a guy driving down the road, stops when he sees this farmer holding up this giant pig in his arms, holding up the pig so that the pig can eat acorns out of the tree. And the guy stops his car, runs over, and says, "That's not the way to do that. You know, it'd be much better if you put the pig down, shake the tree, the acorns fall down. You'd save a lot of time that way." And the farmer says, "What's time to a pig?" But I'll do my best. I also feel that I should apologize for the Morrison versus Olson case. I don't know what else to say about it, but I'm sorry. And before I talk about presidential lawmaking, I thought that I could at least have a comment on the subject of the unitary presidency, which was talked about by the previous panel. I think it's interesting that we can have this debate today about the unitary executive, because it is manifestly what the framers debated and decided. Of all of the decisions made at the Constitutional Convention, one of the clearest, cleanest, most thoroughly debated was the decision that we would have a unitary executive rather than a plural executive. And ironically, it is one of the decisions made at the constitutional question which has been overridden and disregarded completely by today, 200 years later, without a constitutional amendment and without a decision by the Supreme Court saying that we shouldn't have a unitary president. But the framers of the Constitution did indeed debate over a Friday, Saturday, and Monday whether there shall be a single president or a multiple president. The reasons for it and against it, some of which you heard in the previous discussion, were debated and argued and so forth. And there was then a vote taken and a decision made that we should have a unitary president. Now, we don't, as you know, have anything like that now. One of the examples, an example of that was given by one of the panelists before, but President Kennedy also said it probably best of all, said in response to some question, "Well, I agree with you, but I don't know whether the government will." And today, and just to use some of the examples that were mentioned, we have the securities laws are not, the enforcement of the securities laws are not responsible, the responsibility of the president. Some of the criminal laws, as we all know, are not the responsibility of the president to enforce. Some of the antitrust laws, national economic policy is vested in an agency called the Federal Reserve Board, which is not the responsibility of the president. Energy policy, communication policy, I could go on and on and on. The president not only cannot control or coordinate and faithfully take care of the execution of the laws relative to those subjects, in fact, it's almost a sin for the president to speak to those people that make those decisions, because every time the president tries to talk to someone on the Federal Trade Commission or the Federal Communications Commission, it's a great scandal here in Washington. And it's big news when the presidential spokesman speaks out, as he did the other day, about something that's within the jurisdiction of the Federal Reserve Board. Judge Breyer made the point that, well, we wouldn't want these decisions to be made in the White House, would we? I mean, wouldn't that be a terrible thing? The person elected by all of the people of the United States to enforce the laws, wouldn't that be terrible if we had those decisions being made by the President of the United States or his subordinates? But that is the person that the framers of the Constitution designated as the person to enforce the laws, not the FCC commissioners. And the problem, one of the problems, is that the plurality of the executive takes those subjects outside the political debate. Because if we don't like the way the SEC enforces the securities laws, what are we going to do about it? Hope that we can convince our congressman to change it. But the fact is, it doesn't come up in presidential debates. It doesn't get written into the platform of the presidential election because it's irrelevant. It's not something the president can do anything about. We should probably spend a little bit of time talking about the subject that we were assigned to talk about, which is presidential lawmaking. In order to try to figure out what to say about that, first of all, tried to figure out what is lawmaking and what is pretty elementary. What is lawmaking and what is the execution of the laws? Those are the divisions that are set forth in the Constitution. And we all know that it's difficult to draw the line between what is enacting a statute, which is a broad policy decision which Congress does, and enforcing the statute based upon discretion, which is what the executive is supposed to do. The Supreme Court in the Chadha decision defined legislation, declared that Congress couldn't perform it except as prescribed in the presentment clauses of the Constitution, that is both houses and in submission to the president, and then implicitly upheld Congress's authority to delegate that power to the president, because the decision there was whether or not to suspend a deportation. And the court held that that was lawmaking and that the Congress couldn't do it because it hadn't done it in the prescribed way, and implicitly upheld the fact that the president could do it. That in doing all this, the court defined legislation as action that had the purpose and effect of altering the legal rights, duties, and relations of persons. I don't know how far that gets us, but I thought someone ought to throw out here a definition of lawmaking. And then I tried to itemize for myself, so that I could pass on to you, some of the ways in which the president constitutionally participates in the lawmaking process. And I was surprised to come up with more than I thought that I would, because when you start to itemize these things, you come up with the following. One, the president, through his subordinate, presides over the Senate. His subordinate, the vice president, presides over the Senate and may cast a tie-breaking vote in the legislative process directly. Number two, we've talked about the veto power, and I should say, including the pocket veto. There are two kinds of vetoes, as you know, return vetoes and pocket vetoes. Most of the time that you think about it is a return veto, because Congress is in session, and under the Constitution, the president must send the bill back to the House that originated the legislation with his objections, so that body of Congress can immediately decide whether to reconsider it and pass it over the president's veto. Only a small fraction of presidential vetoes are overridden. But there is also the pocket veto. When Congress has adjourned, the president need not send the bill back because Congress isn't there to receive the legislation. So the president simply doesn't do anything at all. Now, the pocket veto doesn't get talked about too much, but although it was the subject of some legislation about 10 or 15 years ago, but it's becoming increasingly important because actually, although the framers denied the president the so-called absolute veto, which is to kill a bill, period, and in favor of the return veto, which can be overridden, the pocket veto is more like an absolute veto because it does kill the bill. Congress has to repass it over again, and then that repassage of the bill may be subject to a presidential veto again. And it's important because Congress has adopted the posture increasingly of passing all of its major legislation in the last 5 days, or maybe the last 5 minutes of a congressional session. You know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and it's all in one bill like this. So the president maybe can't veto it, but if he could, a pocket veto could be a very powerful thing. In the 90, I did it when I was in the Justice Department, I did a calculation. In the 94th, 95th, 96th, and 97th Congresses, somewhere between 25% and a third of the bills passed were passed within the last 10 days of the congressional session. Now, that wasn't a necessarily completely accurate count, but I wanted to figure out how important the pocket veto was, and I came to the conclusion it was a fairly important thing. The third way in which the president may participate in the legislative process is the pardon power. That, in a sense, is altering the legal rights of persons. It may be used in a specific sense, or it may be used in a very general sense, such as after the Civil War or after the Vietnam War. The fourth way in which the president may participate in the legislative process is the power to make treaties subject to congressional concurrence. But treaties become the law of the land, and the president participates by negotiating treaties. And treaties become, as along with the Constitution and laws, the supreme law of the land. The next way is executive agreements, which are widely perceived as ways in which the president may get around the congressional participation in the treaty power. But however one might come out on the appropriateness or legality of the executive agreements, it is something that has been done by many presidents throughout our history. The Louisiana Purchase was an executive agreement. It was bought and paid for before congressional participation was sought. President Roosevelt's agreement to lend 50 destroyers to Great Britain in exchange for the right to lease air and naval bases was, and which arguably violated two statutes, was pursuant to an executive agreement. The annexation of Texas and later of Hawaii came about in the same way. The next way is, as you all know, and someone referred to this before, is the president and his ability as a rhetorician, oratory. The president is specifically given the power in the Constitution to recommend measures. That's depending upon the popularity of the president. That's a very significant way to participate in the legislative process. The president has the power to convene Congress, which is in a sense a way to participate. The way that we've all the thing that we all understand as presidential participation is law enforcement. However you cut it, taking care that the laws are faithfully executed involves the president in making decisions as to who shall be enforced, how the laws shall be enforced. Some laws, perhaps they may involve excessive delegations, but whether they do or not, and I don't know whether the antitrust laws would fall into that category, but vast amounts of discretion are given to the president to make decisions. The next area that occurs to me is the power of the president through the Justice Department to decide what cases to present to the courts and what arguments to make and to not make to the courts. And we've heard a little bit about not defending statutes, but the power as to select the cases to present to the courts, what cases to appeal. If you agree that courts make law, that's a very important power to control what arguments are made to the court. Another area is signing statements, and through the process of signing statements, the president explains how he understands a statute, and that becomes a part, frequently, of legislative history. Executive orders carry the force of law. Executive Order 9981 integrated the armed forces by President Truman. Executive Order 12291, which was a Reagan administration executive order, reformed the regulatory process in the executive branch. The regulations themselves under statutes, both authorized by Congress specifically and sometimes just done by the executive branch without specific authorization. The Supreme Court held, as we heard earlier in U.S. versus Nixon, that a regulation enacted by the Justice Department was even enforceable against the president, who had the power to override the regulation, but if he hadn't done so, it was still enforceable against him. Another area, and I will try to be brief as to the rest of these things, but it's important to mention a few of them, are the emergency powers, sometimes described as presidential prerogative, sometimes criticized as presidential law breaking. Locke initially described the powers of the president necessarily in an emergency, or the power of the executive in an emergency, to do something which may not be authorized by law and may in fact be contrary to law. I'm not offering this as a defense of this process necessarily, but it is there. Jefferson explicitly defended this power. It's mentioned indirectly in some respects in Federalist 28 and 41. An example that you're all aware of is when Congress was not in session when Fort Sumter fell, President Lincoln proclaimed a blockade of southern ports, mobilized state militia, increased the size of the Army and Navy, and appropriated funds for war material. These acts were not only not lawfully authorized, but they were against not only laws, but the Constitution. The Emancipation Proclamation. The next area that occurs to me is the power to recognize foreign governments. This is a power not necessarily given to the president by the Constitution, but established by President Washington when he recognized Citizen Genet as the ambassador from the new French Republic. It has the force, it had and it has been followed by presidents since then, has the force of law. The final area that I should mention, and it's another controversial one, is does the president have, and under what circumstances, the impoundment power? Can he decide not to spend money that's been appropriated by Congress, and under what circumstances can he defer or rescind appropriations? Those are some of the areas that occur to me which are either explicitly authorized by the Constitution or implicitly authorized by the Constitution for the president to participate in the lawmaking process, and areas in which many presidents have participated in the lawmaking process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. And now I'd like to offer each of the panelists a couple minutes to comment on the other panelists' presentations. I suppose we'll just go in the same order we did in speaking. Professor Schoenbrod?
Thank you. I want to talk about what Ted Olson talked about. I don't necessarily disagree with him, but he raises an interesting point from my perspective, because he reminds me of an argument that was made in favor of delegation during the New Deal times, and I think it's an argument that still persuades many people, but I don't think it holds any water. And the argument goes something like this. Congress can't decide everything. Therefore, we have to have some delegation, and since we can't tell what, there's no clear dividing line, we have to leave it up to Congress to decide how much delegation there is. I don't think that argument makes any sense. Because the delegation, what we're concerned about is the delegation of legislative power, that is the delegation of power given to Congress under Article 1. So if we go through the list that Ted made, we see that a lot of involvements that the president has in lawmaking are not delegations of Congress's Article 1 power. For instance, the veto power, the role of the vice president, the power to recommend, and so on and so on. The second point I want to make, then, is that we need to distinguish between inherent Article II power, i.e. the power of the executive, versus the Article I power of Congress. And so long as what the president is doing is exercising Article II powers, then there isn't any problem of delegation of legislative power. So if what the president is doing is rule enforcement, not rule making, and I think rule enforcement, like Judge Easterbrook does, includes the power to interpret the laws, including the Constitution and statutes. I don't see a problem there, though I do realize that it's a tricky business to distinguish between rule interpretation and rule making. I've written scholarly articles about it, but I think the distinction is valid, and I think when properly made, it's still the purposes of the delegation doctrine are still upheld. Another example of a Article II power, which does not obviously involve the delegation of legislative power, is when the president exercises the war power. I could have the list go on, but it's 2 minutes are up, I'm sure.
Okay, thank you, Professor. Judge Easterbrook?
Some of you may be wondering when we would get to the topic of this panel. The topic is presidential lawmaking powers, vetoes, line item vetoes, signing statements, executive orders, and delegations of rulemaking authority. Now, we got off to a good start from the first talk, but I'm afraid I may have diverted things. So I would like now to address those five topics. Unfortunately, my time is quite brief. My positions are yes, no, yes, yes, and dubious.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. Mr. Ross?
Let me take just a minute to comment on one of the issues that Ted brought up, and let me preface my remarks by saying I had attempted during my 10 minutes to present a list of the president's ample powers in the legislative process. I'm glad that I left the task of filling out the list to Ted, who it came much more naturally to do, and gave a list beyond my wildest expectations. But I think it does prove the point that the president is not powerless if he does not have the authority to simply suspend or ignore a statute. One thing that Ted did talk about is with regard to pocket vetoes, and that is a very timely question. It's interesting that the description of the constitutional provision being that when the Congress is adjourned, the President has the ability to pocket veto the legislation is one that is not exactly correct. And the difference between Ted's description of the constitutional provision and mine, which is that when the Congress by its adjournment prevents its return, is the President able to pocket veto a bill, is the basis of a coming clash between the Congress and the President with regard to the President's authority to pocket veto a bill, and one that is being played out or will be played out in the very first days of the second session of this Congress. The specific controversy is with regard to a statute relating to the fate of Chinese students who happen to have been in the United States at the time of the Beijing uprising. And the question is whether the Congress, by authorizing, by both rule and specific provision, a functionary to receive from the President a veto message, whether the President is therefore obligated to exercise his veto authority by making a return veto, thus preserving the constitutional balance of allowing the Congress to override the veto, or whether simply because Congress is not meeting on the 10th day after the bill has been presented, whether the President can obtain a unilateral and absolute negative on the bill, the provision which was rejected by the framers. And I think the difference between those two readings of that, of those few words, you'll see played out both in on the front pages with regard to the Chinese students bill, and then also in most likely in litigation over the next couple of years.
The pocket veto case, so if this is coming along, that will be kind of fun for all of us separation of powers freaks to watch. I mean, it'll be an interesting thing. I wanted to say simply a couple of things about what the other speakers have said. I agree very much that excessive delegation by Congress is a terrible thing to the executive branch. It is bad for Congress and it is bad for the executive branch. It dislocates accountability. It's partially responsible, in my judgment, for excessive spending because Congress can pass a bill that says we're against, as Justice Scalia said before he was on the Supreme Court, they can all vote in favor of being against unsafe products. So that's a pretty safe thing to vote on. And then there have to come volumes of regulations about that, and no one has really debated what is the cost, where the benefits ought to fall. And they haven't made the hard decisions. Then the hard decisions get made whether they like them or not in the executive branch. I don't think that's good. And it tends to deny citizens due process, too, because the Congress hasn't considered the scope of, and the effect of the legislation that it passes. This whole issue about not enforcing a statute is an interesting thing, but it doesn't come along too often. I would say in response to what Steve says, that the fact that the President may have signed a bill partially for the reasons that Attorney General Thornburg mentioned earlier today, but also for other reasons, does not make the bill constitutional. The Supreme Court specifically said, because that argument was raised in the Chadha decision, that the fact that it may have been passed, a bill may have been passed by Congress and it may have been signed by the President or some President, doesn't make it constitutional. Certainly legislation has a presumption of validity. But that's all. It has a presumption of validity. And the President does have, it seems to me, some responsibility to consider the constitutionality of a statute. It's interesting and hasn't been mentioned that the President of the United States in the Constitution is given a special oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And if that doesn't require some judgment with respect to the enforceability of a statute that he perceives to be unconstitutional, I don't know what it is. That separate oath is a separate oath prescribed verbatim in the Constitution for the President of the United States, and it's a different oath than signed by all other executive officials and other officials of the government. The constitutionality of the Competition and Contracting Act was litigated up to the circuit courts, and then when it got in the Supreme Court, it was moot, so the Supreme Court never did resolve that case. I think my time's probably up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Before we open it up to questions from the floor, I'm told that Professor Walter Burns is the designated questioner for this panel, and he's a professor Olin professor at University, at Georgetown University, and also an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Professor Burns?
Mr. Ross began his analysis of the Take Care Clause with a reference to British practice. That's sound practice on some occasions. For example, when the court for the first time was faced with the necessity of interpreting the ex post facto clause, Calder versus Bull, it went to Blackstone and found an explanation of that language. I don't think it's appropriate in this particular case when we're talking about the Take Care Clause, because the principle of Britain is legislative supremacy, whereas the principle of the United States is constitutional supremacy. Now, it seemed to me you then recognized that difference when you went on to suggest, as I understood you, that constitutional questions are finally decided by the Supreme Court of the United States or by the judiciary. The question then arises whether, in a case involving the president is required to obey a court order. Now, there is one famous occasion involving a not insignificant president of the United States, namely Abraham Lincoln, who, faced with a court order handed down by the Chief Justice of the United States, Roger Brooke Taney, refused to obey it. My question to you is the president entitled to do this sort of thing? And to preempt part of the answer, or what I hope will be your answer, there are occasions, and these occasions arise when precisely when the president is involved as an interpreter of the Constitution, when it is altogether improper for the court to have the final word. The final court of constitutional court in some matters is the people of the United States. And it seems to me that the Constitution itself recognizes this in its impeachment and conviction clauses. So one says that the Senate of the United States, but not acting as a legislative body. This, I think, becomes clear in the Constitutional Convention. They had to put this power someplace. But it's the Senate of the United States acting as a court in the name of the people, decide these questions that are inevitable. We're lucky they don't arise too often, but they are inevitable when the president has a different view of the Constitution from the Congress. Is the president, to get to my question finally, is the question, is the president required to obey whatever it is, a court order?
Let me answer in your question in two separate parts. First, with regard to my reliance on the British example, I'm not sure I would agree that with the description of the status of the British governmental system in 1688 as being one of, prior to 1688, as being one of legislative supremacy. And it was the practice prevalent at that time, prior to the Glorious Revolution, of the king's power to suspend laws that that I was relying on, as have the courts in citing that British history. With regard to the And I was talking about the 1688 example. Perhaps we're just speaking past each other. But let me turn to the question as to the president's obligation to follow a final and dispositive resolution of the question of the Constitution by the Supreme Court. I can perhaps best answer with respect to my view of that question by telling you what I have on a number of occasions advised members of the House of Representatives with respect to rulings of the court relating to the House and its members. I have taken the position, and members of the House have agreed with the position, that the House would comply with dispositive rulings, final resolutions of questions by the Supreme Court. Is there the practical potential that another governmental body, be it the president or a House of Congress, would refuse to abide by a final decision. Clearly there is. I would hope that we don't see that day. I think that those of us who practice law, and particularly governmental law, do owe some obligation to the notion of the rule of law. And I think a part of the system that was crafted by the constitutional framers is one in which there will be an ultimate resolution of the question by the court. Now, it's true that, as you say, the final arbiter is are the people of the United States. And a president who is, or a Congress, displeased with a ruling by the Supreme Court has at their disposal several means of going to the people and changing the law of the land, be it through a constitutional amendment, be it through a bill that changes the composition of the court, be it through persevering and putting on the court people who will agree with the vision shared by the majority of the people if it differs with the court. But I would end by saying that I would hope the day does not come when either the president on one hand or the Congress on the other hand decides that it is within their constitutional prerogative to simply ignore final resolution of constitutional questions by the court.
Thank you. Any of the other panels wish to address that question? I think we'll flip back and forth across the room. Alden?
Yes, Alden Abbott. Judge Easterbrook said yes to signing statements, and as an alumnus of OLC, I guess I also would say yes. The question remains, however, what happens, as the president has on a number of occasions, what happens when the president says in his signing statement, I'm signing this law, however, certain clauses of law, I believe, raise serious constitutional problems or are unconstitutional. To what extent does that justify the president's decision not to enforce or execute the law? And moreover, what role should that action play in the court's review of the law? And in addition, how should that be viewed as an integral part of legislative history?
I take it that was a question to me.
Or to anyone else who'd care to chime in. Well, if Judge Easterbrook cares to draw a bias.
Let me expand my yes a little bit in that regard. When you suggest that when the president in a signing statement says he views the law as dubious or unconstitutional, that would then be authority for something, that would be circular. Whether something is constitutional or not will depend on the underlying constitutional arguments, not on whether the president himself has said it earlier. The signing statements are, I think, most useful in demonstrating the understanding of the law's meaning and scope at the time. The decision not to veto a law, as to veto it, is part of the legislative process. And I think that the president's signing statements are entitled to the same kind of weight as, say, a statement in the Senate by the responsible revenue committee, the finance committee, that it is sending on a piece of legislation to the floor because it believes it understands has the following meaning. As a rule, I think those statements are not entitled to very much weight. They tend to be ex post. They tend to be written by staffers. All the difficulties of legislative history apply to the president's signing statement as well. We don't suppose these days that this is really the president of the United States expressing his own views. It wasn't even in the time of President Jackson, who sent off to the House Roger Taney's non-signing statement in the Bank of America case, in the Bank of the United States case. But it is entitled to the same kind of weight as contemporaneous legislative history, that it is one of the three people whose concurrent approval must be obtained, expressing what he understands those words to mean.
Well, I would just add that the Supreme Court in the Chadha decision, in this footnote 13, in which they said that the fact that the president had signed the bill containing the legislative veto did not make it constitutional, noted in that footnote that I don't know how 11 presidents, the court said, from Mr. Wilson through Mr. Reagan, who have been presented with this issue have gone on record at some point to challenge congressional vetoes as unconstitutional, and it collects in that footnote signing statements. So the Supreme Court regarded it as having some significance that the president although having signed bills containing legislative vetoes, felt that they were unconstitutional, that carried some weight with the court.
Thank you.
My name is Paul Jensen. I attend law school at Duke University. Mr. Olson mentioned the subject of impoundment briefly. I'd like to ask if Mr. Ross would state the case against such a presidential power being constitutional, and then ask if someone else on the panel might tell him if he's wrong.
Well, I guess I can simply state that the Constitution lodges the power of the purse in the Congress. It is a determination to be made by the representatives elected by the people to Article I Houses of Congress to determine how the funds collected by the government shall be spent. That in working out with the executive the ways to do so, the Congress has elected in several manners to provide the executive with certain flexibility, but not to provide the executive with other flexibility, and that absent such a congressional grant, the president does not have the authority to change the appropriations of the Congress. That was one of the very basic powers that the framers determined to give to Article I.
Any other comments on the impoundment question?
I'd like to see what Judge Easterbrook had to say about it, but when I was in the Office of Legal Counsel and we considered these questions, we found that the legislation varied a great deal. Some legislation was very explicit, saying that mandatory expenditures were required and Congress was very clearly on record. Some was Congress had explicitly given flexibility to the executive, as Steve says. But in some of the legislation, it was unclear at all. Congress apparently hadn't given any thought to it, and it seemed to us then that the answer to that question might well, in the latter two instances, might depend upon the language used in that particular case and what the courts might discern the flexibility would be if Congress had made it clear that it insisted that certain money had to be spent a certain way. I think Congress does have the power to do that.
And let me just pick up with that. I think it is clear to anyone that has reviewed the history of this area that there are many instances in which the language emanating from the Congress has been less than crystalline in its direction to the executive branch. The remedy for that is better drafting by the Congress. It is not the development of a new constitutional authority by the executive branch, and that is something that there certainly has historically been demonstrated that there is a need for attention to be paid to.
I could give you another small piece of history, kind of executive history. During the Nixon administration, a broad claim of power to impound was made, and it was uniformly rejected by the lower federal courts. The government filed a cert petition in a case involving some environmental matters, a train against the city of New York, it was called. The Solicitor General at the time was Robert Bork. Solicitor General Bork took a very close look at the arguments pro and con on impounding and withdrew the government's claim that there was inherent executive authority to impound, and made in that case exactly the argument Ted Olson just suggested. That is, that particular statute was not written in a way to require the expenditure of money, conceding that other statutes might be so written without being unconstitutional. The Supreme Court in that case, by a 9-0 vote, rejected the argument even with respect to that particular statute. But it has always seemed to me that what Solicitor General Bork did at the time, the conclusion he came to, was exactly right.
I'd like to sharpen the Lincoln question a little bit. As I understand what the Supreme Court did in Dred Scott was to say that where Dred Scott was found was not important in determining what laws were to apply to him, that the state whence he came, which determined that he was property, that those laws could be enforced to determine that he should be sent back to that state rather than the state where he was found, which said that he was to, that he could not be considered a piece of property. And as I understand it, that raised a question about the constitutionality even of enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act. Now, I could be wrong in the history, but assuming all this, if you were President Lincoln, assuming the Union had stayed together, and you had come to the conclusion that the Supreme Court had made a grave constitutional error in deciding that the laws of northern states would not be applied to determine that slaves were no longer property, if you decided that that was an error, would you still, because of the fact that the Supreme Court had passed on it and the fact that Congress had duly enacted the statute, would you still have an obligation to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, even if you thought doing so would be unconstitutional? And I'd direct that to Mr. Ross and Judge Easterbrook.
Can I say that I think you have indeed misunderstood both the case and the history? You know, the Fugitive Clause is not simply in a statute, it's part of the Constitution. The Constitution requires the executive of states to deliver up fugitives. And in saying I'm not going to demand or enforce the delivering up of fugitives, Lincoln would have been acting inconsistent with the Constitution, not with a statute. But I also think you misunderstood the facts of the Dred Scott case. Scott was not found in a free state. His claim was that he had traveled through a free state, had come back to a slave state, and that had liberated him. And what the Supreme Court held in one of the most bizarre opinions of all time is that the whole idea of liberating slaves was unconstitutional, that black people could not be citizens of the United States. It was that made the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. They gratuitously declared the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional, even though it had already been repealed, and made almost everything impossible from that stage forward.
I'll subscribe to it.
Hi, my name's Ira Goldman. I have one point on line item veto, which I don't know that it's been mentioned, but is in the title of the list of things to be considered. A point that is being pressed on the president by some is that a line item veto already exists in the Constitution. If the president were to accept that point of view and decide to take on that issue, for Judge Easterbrook and for Steve Ross, how do each of you feel that that should be approached by the president based on what you've said as far as how a president should reconcile his view of the Constitution and the Take Care Clause?
I'm not sure that it poses exactly for the president the question that I was presenting, because I was supposing that the law had been enacted by valid processes, either with his signature or over his veto, and he must then decide between that and his understanding of the Constitution.
Well, consider that with the
line item veto question, I take it, if the president decided that he possesses that power, which seems to me very difficult to reconcile with the text of the Constitution, which says he can return a bill, right? That's his opportunity. But assuming he decides he has this power, he then would, I assume, send a veto message, make a return veto to the Congress saying he is vetoing section 2A3 little I subpart 2 footnote 5 and say that that has been vetoed. And then I assume he has done what he thinks he has done. He may have made a mistake, but it's not technically a non-enforcement decision in the sense that I was originally imposing it.
Enforcement in the sense of the Impoundment Act, and that prescribes by statute how funds are supposed to be not spent. Is there not a conflict there that if he wants to withhold the expenditure of funds, he should follow that procedure rather than what he sees?
I think you can imagine
Constitute.
A conflict at the next stage. The president makes veto subsection 2A3, right? Congress in an opinion drafted by Mr. Ross, sends back a letter saying,
"Sorry, but
dear Mr. President, some crank has obtained copies of your stationery and is sending letters over your name. You have signed this law and it is now in force. It's not our obligation to do anything, right? If the subsection he's vetoed is something that puts obligations on him as opposed to creating rights in private parties, he then has to make the kind of judgment I was talking about whether he will enforce it. I think he has the constitutional entitlement to make that judgment. But as Mr. Ross said, and I'm persuaded he's correct, not only for the president, but for the two other branches, it is extremely grave business to decline to enforce decisions of any of the other branches. It is absolutely essential to the long-term stability of any republic that there be great deference given by each of the two branches to the work of the other two. The Supreme Court routinely says that about its holding statutes unconstitutional. And although one may doubt that its expressions are consistent with its practices in that regard, the expressions are the sounder. And the president is well advised to follow the expressions.
Judge Easterbrook, just a quick follow-up. Would that mean, therefore, that the president would sit in judgment on his own determination to not enforce a provision that he had implicitly vetoed?
If he thought the statute was not law, he would not enforce it. I mean, that's how the pocket veto cases come up. The Congress says in the legislation that Mr. Ross referred to, they've named an agent who will always be there to accept a return, and the Constitution says except when their adjournment prevents its return. So the argument in this legislation and the rules is that there is always someone there, so return is always possible. The president believes, however, that the Constitution means the members of Congress are there rather than an agent. So the president makes a pocket veto and then takes the position that this bill is not a statute and he won't enforce it. I think it's wholly appropriate for him to take the view that a particular document is not duly enacted law. Litigation may then ensue or it may not. But whether something is a duly enacted law is something the president has to decide.
I have a question for Mr. Ross. I gather the argument in favor of the line item veto is that really what Congress has done in putting together a statute like this is put many bills together, and the president therefore is vetoing one bill out of many. I don't know how the president decides which among this pile of stuff is a bill. I mean, he could veto anything, everything but the word not, or everything except the word not. But would your position be, if the president had sent you one of these letters, that you vetoed the whole thing or you haven't vetoed anything?
I guess it would depend in part on the crank letter that was.
I mean, whether you like the outcome.
That was referred to. Yeah. I mean, the president, in his return message, it would depend on his choice of words. And it can at times be a difficult job to discern exactly what has happened. Go back to the example of the Chinese student bill, in which the president said, in a message delivered to the Houses of Congress, because I can't deliver this message to you, I therefore have pocket vetoed the bill, but because I know that there is some confusion about this matter, I'm returning the bill with my veto. And the Congress is scheduled to take up the question of whether or not to override this veto, and the White House is, according to the press, working late at night trying to sustain this veto, which may or may not have occurred. My guess is that if the president were to be persuaded by what I am convinced is a very small minority, even among pro-executive legal scholars within the executive branch, that the authority for a line item veto somehow has existed unbeknownst to all of the presidents, and therefore that he would seek to utilize it, that we would have as difficult a time wending our way through whatever message was sent up. And I would hesitate to hazard a guess whether the House would try to override such a veto. I think it's more likely that the way the letter would then come up is we would say, sorry, but that's not a veto.
So therefore, the bill, the whole bill would have been passed and made into law.
I think that's the more likely, although again, I'd want to wait till we saw the letter, but I think that's probably the most likely outcome.
Thank you.
My name is Mike Paulson. I'm with the Department of Justice. I have a question for Judge Easterbrook. You perhaps prudently abstained from answering Walter Burns' question about the authority of the president to defy court judgments and then managed to duck it in the Dred Scott hypothetical. I'd like to hold your feet to the fire once again. Does not your view that the executive has inherent authority to, in interpreting the Constitution independently, to not enforce statutes also imply that the president has authority to not enforce court judgments that he thinks are unconstitutional decisions or rendered in excess of the court's jurisdiction?
Now, who am I? Do I look like a traitor to my caste? Perhaps I have this suspicious air about me in some way. First, I think it's important to understand that there are now acknowledged ways in which presidents do routinely ignore judicial orders. That doctrine is one known as the limitations on offensive non-mutual issue preclusion in federal litigation. For those of you who cannot do that, I suggest mouthing off rubber baby buggy bumpers real fast. There was a long controversy about whether when one U.S. Court of Appeals decides a case that is binding nationwide on other litigants. The Supreme Court of the United States held unanimously in a case called United States against Mendoza that it is not, that decisions of district courts and indeed courts of appeals are not uniformly binding, they are binding between the litigants. And that was thought to be important. Now, the Supreme Court carved itself out of that, sort of. The question is whether the same kinds of principles apply in some cases decided by the Supreme Court. That is something on which a series of presidents have spoken, but very few have acted. Thomas Jefferson was of the view that the power of constitutional review is a power exercised absolutely independently by each branch, but he never really acted on it besides pardoning people. It is a view that President Jackson and President Lincoln, and for that matter, President Roosevelt have taken, the second President Roosevelt have taken quite forcefully. It is a position that, as a logical matter, in the end, is unavoidable. If the Supreme Court of the United States does something absolutely wacky, and as in Lincoln's case, he perceives the security of the Union at stake, it is his constitutional duty to save the Union and disregard the wacky decision. Saying that that is possible in theory is, of course, extraordinarily different from saying that it ought to be done. Like the United Kingdom, which has managed to get on without a constitution, although with a Bill of Rights after the Glorious Revolution, the constitutional structure of this government has been worked out in practice. Judicial review does not exist in the Constitution. It was inferred from structure. It was, right? A lot of people talked about judicial review, but if you look for the judicial review clause, it is not there. It is inferred from structure, and for many later commentators, was inferred, as Holmes and Hand once said, out of the terror of the alternative, which they perceived as chaos or the dissolution of the Union. When those kinds of things are present, it seems to me the president must equally have the authority to act. But as I've emphasized several times, it must be quite extraordinary. We have seen these occasions very rarely in our history. One hopes we will see them less rarely in the future. I mean, more rarely in the future. Oh, dear. Turn that tape back, please. More rarely. Less frequently.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. We've got time for one more question.
Yes, my name is Tom Odom. I have a question for Mr. Ross. If a bill is passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the president, and thereafter a subsequent president believes the legislation is unconstitutional, wouldn't he need to direct the suspension of that statute to present a case or controversy to obtain judicial review?
Not necessarily. Most, virtually all laws have impact that reaches beyond the confines of the governmental structure, and there will be other people who will be affected, and who can present to the courts the question of the constitutionality of the statutory provision. It then raises a further question, which was somewhat alluded to here before, and I might take a moment to address, and that is, does the executive branch have an obligation, notwithstanding their current distaste or dislike or even constitutional questioning of a statutory provision, have some obligation to defend it in court? Some of you may be aware of what has become an ever-increasing and frankly rather troubling portion of the role of my office, which is to step into the breach, as it were, and to provide an official defense of statutes that the executive branch has declined to defend before the courts. I say it's troubling. It actually is, as you might imagine, probably the most enjoyable and intellectually stimulating part of my job. But from a governmental structure, it is somewhat troubling. I'll give you one current example. There's a 50-some-odd-year-old statute on the books with regard to the sale of and advertising of beer and malt beverages. The statute prohibits the use and utilization of alcoholic content on either the label or the advertising and the marketing of such alcoholic products. The constitutionality of that statutory provision and its enforcement by the BATF was challenged by a large beer manufacturer in litigation which is currently pending. When the case was presented originally to the court, a determination was made by the Department of Justice that there was no way, no reasonable constitutional defense that could be offered on behalf of that statutory provision. And the department walked into court and conceded the unconstitutionality of the statute. That's troubling, especially in light of the fact that several months later, the Solicitor General, when the case was in the Court of Appeals, said, well, gee, it's my role to review the position of the United States in appellate litigation, and I frankly feel that not only are there reasonable defenses of the constitutionality that can be offered, but that it's a fairly easy defense to make. And the United States, on the executive branch, is now stepped back into the case and is joined us in the defense of the constitutionality of the statute, which is currently pending before the circuit court. And that notion that a lawyer will be sitting at the Department of Justice and saying, well, gee, is this a statute worth defending or not, is troubling. And I think it's a further question on the whole area of the role of the executive branch with regard to statutes that that people should be taking a look at.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. Thank all of the panelists for the tremendous presentations.